Hello, and welcome to Tales from Imperial Russia, with Dr. James White. Episode 24, A City Under Siege, the Tale of Rudolf Felix Bauer. It was a balmy summer day in June 1704 when the two old friends met before the city walls. Rudolf Felix Bauer, a colonel in the Russian army, greeted his former superior Nolder, a militia captain in Swedish service, with all due courtesy. No record exists of what the two men said to one another, although most likely things were genial, with handshakes exchanged and mutual inquiries made. The conversation was held in German, the mother tongue of both men. Nolder was probably quite curious about Bauer's meteoric fortunes. When last the two had seen each other, Bauer had been accused of murdering a superior, apparently during a duel. Now he stood as one of the highest-ranking officers in the Russian army of Field Marshal Boris Sheremetev, one of Peter the Great's most trusted cronies. It may have been they discussed old boozing sessions, since one of the results of a talk was Nolder's gifting of wine for a cask of Russian mead from Bauer. But eventually they had to come to business. It was time to deal with the dead. Around them were the corpses of 48 men. The officers were identifiable, dressed as they were either in the sea blue jackets of Sweden or in Russian grass green. The others were largely naked, stripped for loot. All were the victims of a recent sortie. 500 Swedish infantrymen, accompanied by cavalry, horse-mounted townsmen, and a gaggle of refugee peasants armed with spades and pitchforks had sallied forth from the besieged university town of Tartu, today in Estonia, but then known as Dorpat, a borderland outpost in the Swedish Empire. The job of the raiders was to tear down the Russian trenches slowly creeping forward towards the walls, but they had failed, mostly due to disorganisation among the Swedish officers. Now under the shelter of a brief ceasefire, Bauer and Nolder's job was to identify, gather and bury the luckless fallen, a mere handful of the hundreds of thousands to die in the Great Northern War of 1700 to 1721, a titanic struggle between Sweden, Denmark, Poland, Prussia and Russia for the fate of Eastern Europe. Once their grim task was accomplished, Bauer and Nolder took their leave and returned to their respective sides. Now they could begin shooting at each other once more. Were the old comrades wistful that the fortunes of war had brought them to this, or were they more matter-of-fact? Both knew that the swapping of sides was business as usual in early 18th century European warfare, where national loyalties were too little developed to stand a chance against ambition, advancement, and cold hard cash. Indeed, if Nolder knew anything about Bauer, he must have known he had form in this regard. Born in 1667 in the North German town of Husum, then ruled over by a client of the King of Sweden, Bauer had joined the Swedish army. This brought him to Livonia, modern Estonia and Latvia, and thus into Nolder's orbit. But the aforementioned murder of a fellow officer at some point in the 1690s had forced Bauer to search for yet another new employer. This time, Augustus II, King of Poland, Elector of Saxony, and enemy of Sweden. Bauer's career, up until this point, neatly encapsulates the geopolitics of Eastern Europe by the end of the 17th century. Swedish empire building over the last 200 years had been tremendously successful, repeatedly smashing its rivals to take territories in northern Germany and Livonia, in effect turning the Baltic Sea into a Swedish lake, given their long-established control over Finland. But ascendancy bred animosity. By the end of the 1600s, the Danes, Poles, Russians, and North German powers had begun to foment an anti-Swedish alliance. Tsar Peter of Russia and Augustus II of Saxony-Poland were casting their jealous gaze over the Livonian provinces. Both sought a grudge match with Sweden in the Battle for the Baltics, having gained and then lost lands in a nearly ceaseless conflict waged between 1558 and 1629. Peter also wanted access to the sea, both to achieve his dream of a grand Russian navy and to offer European merchants a northerly means to circumvent Turkish-dominated trade routes to Persia, India, and China. Livonia, today modern Estonia and Latvia, was an unusual corner of Europe. As a result of Catholic crusading against the pagan tribes and Orthodox Rus from the mid-12th century onwards, control of the region fell to German-speaking elites, rich merchants in the towns, and aristocratic knights in the countryside. Collectively declared undeutscher, or non-German, the Estonians and Latvians were reduced to servile populations. In the rural areas bearing onerous duties of free labour and payments in kind, in return for the privilege of working and living on the manors of their German betters. In urban areas, the natives were barred from settling within the city walls, forming unprotected wooden suburbs filled with craftsmen and labourers. But, unlike their countryside compatriots, these town dwellers were at least free, legally speaking. As in German medieval municipalities, living for a year and a day in the city limits freed refugee peasants from their state of bondage. The largest cities, Riga and Tallinn, known then as Reval, made their fortunes from peddling flax, timber, amber and honey to eager northern and western European markets, as well as exotic furs brought in by traders from the lands of the Rus. This wealth, combined with various autonomies and privileges wrested away from the ruling Teutonic order, made the mayors, councils, guilds and burghers of the Baltic towns significant political forces in their own right. All this was also true of Tartu. The city's waterway, the river Emajõgi, connected it to one of Europe's largest lakes, Peipus to the Estonians and Chudzgoya to the Russians. From there, traders had access both to the Russian principality of Pskov and to the Baltic Sea if one travelled northwards and coursed along the river Narva. However, Tartu's medieval heyday had well and truly passed by the end of the 17th century. First, the Protestant Reformation had shattered the city's role as a pivotal point of the Catholic Church. Then came the breakup of the Teutonic Order in 1558, and thus the final end of Europe's last Crusader state. The subsequent free-for-all over territory led to dramatic falls in Tartu's population, as famine, disease, and battle during repeated sieges took their deadly toll. Even the founding of the university in 1638 and a few decades of stability brought by Swedish rule could hardly dim the fact that the town folk had lost at least half of their number between 1558 and 1699, leaving around only 2,500 urbanites and suburbanites. This then was the stage for the next act in Rudolf Felix Bauer's life. The countryside and towns of Livonia, stalked by hungry Polish, Russian, and German predators, eager to foist the Swedes back across the Baltic Sea. The war began with three strikes. Denmark hit the Swedish client, Ducal Holstein, in fact Bauer's home state. Augustus II, leading Saxon troops, then marched on Riga, and finally Russia, the only one of the three to officially declare war on Sweden, struck at Narva, laying siege. Bauer smelled an opportunity, choosing as his companion an English merchant by the name of Samuel Mew. Bauer appeared before the walls of Narva, using his old Swedish army contacts to obtain access to the town. The odd double act wielded so much trust but they were able to inspect the city defences before quickly fleeing straight out of the gates to the besiegers, where Bauer traded his information for a commission in the Russian army. Mew, meanwhile, went on to found a business concern in St. Petersburg, a city founded almost as soon as the Russian army marched onto the Baltic coast. Whatever intelligence Bauer gave the Russians, it was not to do them much immediate good. A Swedish relief army inflicted a staggering defeat on the Russian force arrayed around Narva, driving them back, for the meantime at least, to home soil. But to the south, Tartu was on a war footing. The city quickly became flooded with refugees, as nobles and their Estonian peasants fled manors for the relative safety of the city walls. In charge was General Karl Gustav Skeeter, a career soldier who had seen long service in both the Swedish and Dutch armies. When news came of the Saxon approach to Riga, Skeeter informed the Governor-General of Swedish Livonia. "No matter what happens there in Riga, I am preparing to confront the enemy, in the first place leaning on God for help so as to stand firm in the face of the foe. From nearby estates, I have mustered a few thousand peasants who should be able to block the enemy's passage. And, if necessary, I can assure your excellency that I can, and I will, go up against them as an honest man." Skeeter handed out weapons to the local population, ordered the stockpiling of firefighting equipment, and administered loyalty oaths in both German and Estonian in Tartu's town hall. Merchants were forbidden from mentioning military activities in their correspondence. But Skeeter's problems were legion. First was persuading the reluctant townsmen to turn up for guard duty. A first muster in early April had rendered lackluster results, compelling Skeeter to make attendance at such drills mandatory. Next was the task of housing an expanded garrison of around 2,000 men. The city council and the German burghers did their best to refuse housing to officers and soldiers. This was not simple short-sightedness or overly zealous defence of traditional privileges. The beginning of hostilities had sent noble and peasant refugees pouring into the city, hoping to find safety behind the walls. Space in even the elite districts was now at a premium. Thus, it took a direct order from King Charles XII of Sweden to force the town to comply with Skeeter's requirements. King Charles was soon to cause Skeeter and Tartu an even bigger headache. Fresh from his victory at Narva over the Russians, the young monarch marched his troops to the nearby village of Lajoza, whence he issued insistent demands to the city for money, food, horse fodder, clothing and beer. The bakeries of Tartu began operating around the clock to churn out enough bread, while the city garrison raided private property in the hope of finding hidden stores of hops for the brewing of beer. Beer was not just for helping the soldiers relax. In the early 18th century, the poor quality of drinking water and the many medical benefits ascribed to beer made it entirely essential. Even when King Charles left to take the fight to Poland in the summer of 1701, Skeeter still had a whole host of logistical problems, including extraordinary amounts of human excrement piling up around the city walls. Those fortifications themselves were in need of repair, for which money, men, and resources had to be found. Tartu was rather well equipped in this regard, with much of its circumference covered by the squat, thick walls typical of 17th century siege engineering, designed to stop cannon volleys dead in their tracks. Only the north and east of the city had thinner, taller curtain walls, but here the river Imajoki and the swamps around it afforded natural defence. Charles's departure had a further, even more deleterious effect. Russian forces from Pskov began to push westwards, winning a major victory over the Swedish forces left in the region at the Battle of Homoli on the 18th of July 1702. With the way now clear, Tsar Peter ordered his commander, Boris Sheremetev, to plunder his way to Tallinn. Sheremetyev announced complete success in this to his ruler a few months later.
I hereby inform you that the Lord Almighty and the Holiest Mother of God have made your wish come true. There is no way the enemy land could be pillaged any more. All has been sacked and laid waste. But I have a concern. What should I do with the prisoners? The lockups are full, filled mostly with people of the common sort. The peril is great, because the prisoners are angry. It is well known to you how much harm they have done, not sparing themselves, how much gunpowder they have set off in the cellars through mischief. Crowded together as they are, they may start dying soon. Feeding them costs much money. One regiment would not suffice to convoy them to Moscow. As for the Estonians, I shall select 100 of the best families, where some can handle the axe, and the rest are masters of other crafts. Altogether 400 souls, to exile them to Azov. Some of these Estonian exiles were found by the Swedish field army during its campaigning in Ukraine in 1708. Although it emerged many preferred to stay, since their new Cossack lords treated them much better than their previous Baltic German masters. Meanwhile, Tartu and its surrounding area were completely exposed to Russian attack. An initial attempt at siege began on the 25th of July 1702, but had to be broken off after only a week due to a lack of siege cannon. A second raid by 1,000 Russian cavalry units got as far as the suburbs on the 1st of January 1703, pillaging for 6 hours before retreating to raid the surrounding countryside and burn Swedish outposts. Such incursions were invariably brutal, with one woman reported impaled and burnt alive during a sally into the Alatskivi area in May 1703. But Swedish action was not limited to defence. In the same month, Skytte deployed his Karelian horsemen to intercept a raid, releasing 300 prisoners, mortally wounding the Russian commander, and stealing his prize camel. History does not record the fate of the unfortunate beast. In Tartu itself, rumours were now spreading of Estonians joining or supporting the Russian troops, leading to tightened security aimed at local peasants coming to buy supplies in the city. Such concerns fueled anti-refugee sentiment amongst the Swedish garrison, with Skytte repeatedly threatening to expel the derelict evacuees and prohibit grain sales to them. Inevitably, town-army relations also came under strain. Things got so bad that Skytte put the town hall under armed guard to persuade the city councillors to cooperate with his increasingly burdensome demands for military service and billeting, declaring that he believed the lowest soldier was equal to the highest burgher. Hooligan carousing among the troops in the city was accompanied by a ballooning number of prostitutes, mostly from among the indigent refugees. Not one to look a gift horse in the mouth, Skytte had these courtesans registered and employed as street cleaners in exchange for one free meal a day. But now it was only a matter of time before the Russians were ready to launch their main attack, especially given the Swedish army was too busy chasing Augustus II across the length and breadth of Poland to be of much assistance. In April 1704, Peter told Sheremetyev it was now time to capture Tartu. The first step had to be securing the waterways, namely Lake Peipus-Chudskaya and the river Emajogi, so vital for moving men and munitions to any besieging force. This paved the way for a pitched boat battle, as the Swedes rallied a barge brigade to push the Russians off the river. But the battle in early May proved to be a fiasco for the Swedes. The night before setting off, the Swedish captain held a raucous party on his flagship, letting off cannons in a flurry of high spirits. The Russians, hearing the booming guns, realised something was afoot and used their boats to block the chokehold where the river met the lake. When on the next day the Swedish fleet faced the Russian blockade, Panic broke out, especially when it was discovered that their cannons, perhaps as a consequence of the previous night's partying, were not loaded. Battle formation was quickly lost. With reinforcements blocked by a flood further downriver, the Swedish sailors began jumping overboard, hoping to swim ashore and beat the retreat. Realizing all was lost, the Swedish captain took a torch to his gunpowder supply and blew himself up, rather than face the shame of defeat and surrender. Nothing now stood in the way of the Russians. Leaving his field camp in Pechory on the 21st of May, Sheremetev, 21,000 men and 50 siege cannons, marched on Tartu, arriving on the 4th of June. Facing them was a defending force of around 4,000 to 5,000 men, equipped with 61 cannons. This small advantage in firepower was not all that it seemed, since around 40 of the city's artillery were old, some pieces dating back to the 16th century. The Russians fanned out, completely surrounding the city and bringing barges up the river. Skeeter now had no choice but to burn down the suburbs outside the wall in order to provide a clear firing line for the defenders. To set an example, he ordered his own house set alight first. Pavements and cobblestone were torn up, as these could cause shots to ricochet, while damp ox hides were handed out, placed on roofs as fire retardants during incendiary bombardments. Thus began the siege of Tartu. The Russian goals were simple enough: batter the city walls to create a breach, dig trenches up to the fortifications so their troops could flood into the breaches, and fire mortars into the city to break the defenders' morale. Within 2 weeks, the Russian cannonade became almost ceaseless, going on night and day. 100 buildings were damaged or destroyed, including 2 churches, the arsenal, the town hall, and the university. Skeeter was nearly killed twice while inspecting the damage, with one soldier next to him torn in half. The cathedral and the hay stored within caught fire, saved only by a chance summer shower. Amidst the endless cacophony of whirring shells, explosion, and Russian music from the barge fleet, the battle-hardened Swedish commander reported that the most distressing sound was the nearly constant chorus of screams from the dying and the injured. People were not the only victims. Cows and horses also came under fire, their bodies rotting in the summer heat and releasing a foul stink to join the acrid stench of gunpowder and the smoke from burning houses. Along with the sound, the smell, and the fear caused by battle, there were also the psychological tricks played by minds grasping at any slim straw of hope. Any movement in the Russian camp was interpreted as retreat, while phantom double cannon shot, the signal of a Swedish relief army, were repeatedly heard by the shell-shocked residents. For all the horrors of the encirclement, there were some tragicomic aspects. 18th century sieges were rarely ever watertight. Daily from Tartu's gates emerged herds of livestock, grazing peacefully as cannonballs whirred overhead. Citizens too snuck out, with numerous groups reported fishing in the river. Skeeter threatened them with death, while the Russians just ignored them. This somewhat benign attitude to non-combatants coming to and from the city was exploited by the Swedes, with one Lieutenant Otto Steinbach dressing as a peasant in order to reconnoitre amidst the Russian trenches. And then there was the story with which we opened this tale, Bauer and Nolde quietly chatting and swapping booze while burying their dead. Captured officers ferried letters between the Russian camp and the city, normally to or from families. These men were given their freedom in exchange for promising they would no longer fight, an arrangement presumed to be rock solid, since no officer worth his salt would violate his word and thus his honour by returning to active service. On the 3rd of July, a month into the siege, Peter the Great,
came to check on Sheremetyev's progress. While he was pleased to see that the main Russian trenches were but a few meters from the city gates, he was angered by artillery inaccuracy. Of over 2,000 shot fired, only half had hit the city. Furthermore, Peter was puzzled by a strategic oversight. Why was Sheremetyev focusing on the strong fortifications of the south and east, while leaving B the weaker walls near the river to the north and west? In Sheremetyev's defence, when the army had arrived, the land before these walls had been a swampy quagmire, unpassable and unsuitable for trench construction. But now that the summer sun had baked away the water, Peter insisted on a new line of attack. The coming week marked an intensification of the combat, demanded by the Tsar's impatience. More than 2,000 shells were sent into the city, while nearly 10,000 cannonballs smashed into the defences. One such shot alone had skipped down the main street, taking the heads off numerous pedestrians caught outside. By the 13th of June, this brutal onslaught had its desired effect. Three breaches were smashed into the walls. The storming of the city began, although by error. The Swedes interpreted a small Russian sortie by one of the breaches as the main attack, and rushed to flood the area with troops. The Russians responded in kind, in effect beginning their assault. As always in such sieges, the storming was the bloodiest part, consisting of close-quarters combat accompanied by guns firing into the dense mass of human bodies. Skitter led his men in person, at one point knocked unconscious by a musket shot that hit the side of his head. The Swedish guns ran so hot they had to be cooled with wet mud. The clash of steel and the blast of muskets mingled with the cries of men trampled underfoot. The bloodbath went on for several hours before Skeeter, regaining consciousness, realized he could not hold on for much longer. The Russians had pushed to the inner gates and had already inflicted heavy damage. The rules of war were clear about the choice now facing Skeeter and his beleaguered men. If he fought on, the city would be forfeit, subject to complete sacking as the price of his contumacy. If he surrendered, he could negotiate terms for his troops, and the city would be spared. With no hope of relief and facing overwhelming odds, Skeeter chose to surrender, although he nearly lost the opportunity. Both the first and second drummers sent to beat the call for a truce were shot dead. Finally, a white flag was raised and a trumpet blown, bringing the rout to a close. In its place began a tense calm, with the Russian and Swedish forces amassing on either side of a last battered gate between them, while their commanders negotiated, with Skeeter and Sheremetyev meeting in person for 45 minutes to smooth over the most contentious terms. Finally, at 5 o'clock on the 14th of July, 1704, the articles of surrender were signed, thus ending the siege. In total, the Russians lost around 3,000 to 3,500 men, around 74% of them dying in the storming of the city. Among them were not just Russians, but representatives of the many peoples of the empire, together with mercenaries from across Europe. For their part, the Swedish forces, constituted by Swedes, Estonians, Latvians, Finns, Karelians, Germans and others, lost 1,400 to 2,000 men, again with most being killed during the attack itself. As for the terms, the Swedish soldiers were allowed to leave Tartu without harassment, flying their flags and to musical accompaniment. The officers and a few companies of men were allowed to keep their weapons, musket balls firmly kept in cheek in case of the need for rapid reload. A Russian escort would take these troops to Tallinn. The Russians swore to not cause outrage or distress to the civilian population. However, as vengeance for when Charles XII had violated terms of surrender given to the Russians during the Battle of Narva some 4 years earlier, Peter reneged on some of the terms. Skeeter's residence in Tartu was looted, while the departing soldiers and officers were detained, searched, and stripped of their valuables. It took 2 weeks for the escort to be arranged, and then it was declared that only some of the soldiers would be going to Tallinn, with the rest being sent to Riga or the Russian encampment around Narva, once more under siege. Skeeter and his leading officers were kept hostage in Peter's camp for several weeks, and Skeeter was even trotted out in front of the walls of Narva in an effort to persuade the city's defenders to come to terms. When it was clear that this tactic was useless, Peter released Skeeter to Tallinn, while some of his officers were sent the long way home, marched to Swedish territory in Vyborg, north of St. Petersburg. As for Tartu, Peter entered on the 14th of July, thinly disguised as a lieutenant colonel. The hasty reception cobbled together must have been quite a sight. The strikingly tall, gangly emperor, his features beset by their usual tics, raising a glass of one of the few bottles of wine left in the city to toast the bunch of bedraggled and cowed city councillors standing in the midst of a badly damaged town hall and nervously waiting for their fate to be decided. A double-headed eagle was raised over a damaged building, while the Swedish king's coat of arms on the facade was painted over with Peter's emblem. For the most part, the townsfolk had reason to be relieved. Peter promised the city and its citizens would retain their ancient privileges, and no looting or massacre took place. The Russian field army did not stay for long, marching north to join the ongoing siege of Narva. This left the Alderman to negotiate troop billeting and war contributions with the new commander, much as they had done with Skeeter beforehand. But much worse was to come. The Russians were notably more security conscious than their Swedish predecessors, deeply anxious about the loyalties of their newly conquered subjects. By 1705, heavy restrictions had been put in place, forbidding the citizens of the town, that is to say the Baltic German, councillors, nobles and merchants who lived in the elite part of the city, from leaving the gates without special permission. Lights, shouting and fighting in the streets after dark were banned. The contents of correspondence had to be reported to Russian officers. Violating these terms, even innocently, could have severe consequences. This was the fate of a Lutheran pastor, Adrian Virginius. In 1702-03, Virginius had taken on the role of commando insurgent, gathering bands of bumpkins from around his rural parish of Ottenpar to attack Russian raiders, for which he was dubbed the peasant's colonel. Following the fall of Tartu, however, he had sworn an oath of loyalty to the Russian Tsar and moved to the city. But shortly after this, he was arrested for receiving secret correspondence from his brother-in-law, a captain in the Tallinn militia. While the contents of the letters seemed to have been benign, Virginius was imprisoned and tortured for 21 months. This torture included having his arms tied tightly up and then being dropped, painfully dislocating his limbs. Finally, on the 27th of June 1706, he was beheaded in front of one of the city gates, his last words being spent on wishing Emperor Peter a long and happy reign. Russian severity was caused by their worsening fortunes in the war. A heavy Russian defeat south of Riga in July 1705 opened the entire Baltic region to Swedish sorties. So close did attackers come to Tartu in the winter of 1705 that the Russian defenders poured water over the city walls to make them so icy as to be unclimbable. Meanwhile, a daring Swedish raid of St. Petersburg destroyed masses of the supplies gathered for the city's construction. The attack was taken quite personally by Peter. Finally, in 1706, the Swedish army managed to corner Augustus II in his Saxon territories, forcing him to abandon the war and leave his Russian allies in the lurch. With peace offers being rejected by Charles XII, Peter had to prepare his lands for a Swedish invasion. Slash and burn tactics
were used over a vast swathe of Western Russia to deny the interlopers any resources that they might be able to use. For Tartu citizens, this spelt catastrophe. First came the deportations. In May 1707, 279 people were deported from Tartu to Moscow, mostly from two main groups. Anyone with connections to the Swedish army on the one hand, and craftsmen and their families on the other. The aim, therefore, was to remove anyone deemed a security threat, and anyone whose skills could be used to improve Russian industry. Hence the offer of good wages, good living conditions, and an eventual return to Tartu. However, the Russian definition of security threat was extremely expansive, even including Madeleine Henriksson, the orphan daughter of a dead Swedish soldier. Then, in February 1708, a further 824 people were sent from their homes in Tartu to Vologda, a 600-mile trip during which 12 babies were born to the deportees. From there, some went even further, many to Moscow or Voronezh. Some of these individuals did rather well, such as Peter Tabor, who became a leading official in the Russian College of Commerce, or Dorothea Bruce, hired as a wet nurse by Empress Catherine I, herself abducted from the Baltic provinces several years earlier. The city was now bereft of most of its Baltic German elite. The Estonian suburbanites were told to flee, to go wherever they so chose. The army stripped the city of anything of value, such as copper sheeting from the town hall roof and headstones from the graveyard. The organ from the Church of St. John's was dispatched to St. Petersburg. Finally, on the 12th of July, the fortifications were blown up, the bridges across the river burnt, and all houses and churches set alight. In effect, Tartu was nearly completely destroyed. Kasu Hans, the first native Estonian writer, penned a lament to the town's ruination, still his most famous work. Its final lines read, "The days of grace are over, and I am nothing but a heap of rubble. Oh, woe is me, the poor city of Tartu." Only slowly did things turn around for the city. The Russians won a conclusive victory over Sweden at the Battle of Poltava in 1709, ending Charles XII's invasion of the Russian Empire. By 1710, Peter was in control of both Tallinn and Riga, putting a halt to active combat in the region. In 1714, the Tartu deportees were finally given clearance to return to their hometown. Around 45% of the families returned, the others either preferring to stay or being forced to due to lack of funds. What they found when they returned was a city that was a shadow of its former self, mostly confined to some Estonians living in suburbs that had escaped the fire. Reconstruction was to take decades, giving birth to the elegant neoclassicism that defines Tartu's old town centre today. And what of the man for whom this tale is named? Seeing action in most of the major battles of the first half of the Great Northern War, Colonel Rudolf Felix Bauer continued to rise through the Russian ranks, becoming a cavalry general before his death on campaign in 1717, the same year in which the Swedish commander of Tartu, Karl Skytte, died of gangrene. Peter the Great piled awards onto Bauer, including landed estates and an imperial portrait festooned with diamonds. But perhaps his greatest reward was to be immortalized a century later by Alexander Pushkin, the most celebrated of Russia's poets, in his poem Poltava. Once little more than a down-on-his-luck mercenary captain, Bauer became, through the Great Northern War, a celebrated hero. And this is for no small reason. The victories of which he was an integral part brought Russian dominance over the Baltic provinces all the way down to 1917, when an even more terrible war served as the midwife to the birth of the republics of Estonia and Latvia. But this
Dear friends, is a tale for another time.